Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is Dr. Liliana Mason. Dr. Mason is an assistant professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. She has a bachelor's degree in politics and a PhD in political psychology and is the author of an extremely interesting book entitled Uncivil Agreement: How Politics Became Our Identity. Her research on partisan identity, partisan bias, social sorting, and American social polarization has been published in journals such as the American Political Science Review, the American Journal of Political Science, Public Opinion Quarterly, and Political Behavior. And her work has been featured in media outlets including the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, and National Public Radio. Dr. Mason is going to deconstruct political polarization in America for us, and we're going to discuss the behavioral impact on our nation. Welcome to Deconstructed, Lily.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, let's talk about your book, Uncivil Agreement: How Politics Became Our Identity. You bring together the theory from political science and social psychology. Why is that important in today's environment?
The main reason that it's helpful and productive to think about psychology when we think about politics is that we're all, as voters, just human beings that are behaving and engaging with each other socially. And we have some really deep-seated instincts that really kind of almost primal instincts that drive our behavior, even when we're doing things that we think are kind of rational, like thinking about politics or voting. And so what I really wanted to do in the book is to look at some of these things that are really kind of deep inside us that we don't always think about as part of who we are, that every single human shares, and use that to explain the ways that we're participating in politics. And those very primal things drive prejudice towards others. They drive our actions. They drive our emotions. And so that was the way that I wanted to get into this topic.
Let's talk about identity-based politics, because we hear a lot about that term. What does that term mean, and how does that impact us?
So there's sort of two views about the ways that people engage in politics. One is that we all sort of think very rationally about how we're going to make our choices, and we have issue opinions that are very much based in our own interests and our thoughtful collections of our preferences for what government should do. There's a whole other way of thinking about politics, which essentially says, yes, we have these issue positions, but also we identify with our political parties in the same way that we would identify with our racial group or our religious group or even our sports team that we love the most. And those types of identity-based attachments to our political parties can really, really drive a lot of our decision-making, and in fact, can determine what our issue positions are. If we're strongly enough attached to these partisan identities, it can actually change the way that we think about politics, and it can change our actual attitudes about what we want the government to do, because we want to be consistent with our partisan group, and we want to make sure that we're good members of our group.
Now, participating in a group or identifying with a group tends to create a source of pride and self-esteem, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And in fact, all you have to do to really imagine how powerful these effects can be is to think about how good it feels. You know, if you're a sports fan, how good it feels when your team wins. It's a really exciting feeling. And when your team loses, it's a really kind of devastating feeling. And those are the types of emotions that I've found we are actually applying to our partisan identities and our party wins and losses.
You know, I do a lot of lecturing nationally on in-group and out-group environments. And in the studies that I've read and some of the lectures that I've given, there seems to be three steps, and I'd like your feedback on them. The first step is categorization. We tend to categorize people, including ourselves, in order to understand the social environment. And that's why, as you referenced before, we have social categories: black, white, national origin, religion, adult, child, things like that. And we tend to define appropriate behavior by reference to the norms of that group. Then we go through a social identification where we adopt the identity of the group and we begin to conform with the group norms, and that impacts self-esteem. And then you have the social comparison. Once you're at that level of identification, you start comparing others to yourself, the I'm good, you're bad, or I'm right, you're wrong. And I think we're seeing a lot of that in today's politics. How would you speak to that format of categorization, social identification, and social comparison?
Yeah, I think that's a really great way to break it down. The thing that I think is the key to all three of those steps is that one of the best ways for us to start defending our group and sort of thinking about our group as a really important thing that we're a part of, the best way for us to think of our group as more salient is for it to be threatened. And I don't mean like physically threatened. I mean the status of your group. So if you are a member of a group that's traditionally high status, but you personally, as an individual, don't feel very successful or very high status in the world, you can use that group identity to make you feel better about yourself and your position in the world. And that becomes sort of a lifeline. It becomes a really important thing that you need to hold on to. If then the status of that group is threatened, then all of these things come crashing down for you. This is the thing that's holding you up, that's sort of the balloon that's keeping your self-esteem high. And so to see a threat to the status of that group can be very, very threatening on an individual level for individuals who are not feeling all that high status themselves.
It almost reverts back then to a primitive part of the brain, the fight or flight mechanism, where we have the threat detection. And in milliseconds, we're doing these assessments of height, size, weight, sex, color of hair, color of eyes, color of skin, and so forth. What we've done is apparently created additional categorizations that are easy to identify, at least within our context, of liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, and so forth.
Exactly. And often I measure identification with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party in exactly the same way that I measure identification with racial group, identification with your gender group, identification with your religion. And it behaves exactly the same way. So if you're feeling that the status of your racial group is threatened, and this is actually particularly, I think of this particularly for white identity, it's a good example, is that it seems that traditionally you've had the highest status in society, and then you perceive that maybe that status is not necessarily being challenged, but that other people's status might become equally as high, people will respond by really doubling down on their identification with that group. And in fact, what I've found is that in some of my work that I'm doing right now, I've actually looked at self-esteem. And what I've seen is that people tend to be the most defensive of the most high status groups. So being white, being male, those types of very high status groups are the ones that people kind of defend the most strongly because they're such easy ways to feel that your own self-esteem is high. And if you're in a party that's successful, then that also helps to make people feel better.
Well, that's fascinating insight. Now, Lily, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about identity politics when we come back. Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Liliana Mason, a PhD in political psychology and the author of Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity. Lily, we were talking about the identity politics in somewhat of a generic manner, but your book gets into some fascinating elements. For example, using old words in new ways. Can you explain that to our audience?
This is sort of a nod to the traditional political science debate over these particular terms. And the terms themselves are polarization, ideology, and sorting. And essentially what I'm saying is that the old understanding of these words was very much linked to issue attitudes. So polarization was about Democrats and Republicans becoming more extreme in their preferences for what the government does. Ideology was entirely about the set of policy positions that you hold. And sorting, the political science term that has described this trend that's been happening in American politics, where essentially Democrats are more increasingly liberal and Republicans are more increasingly conservative than they were, for instance, in the 1960s. And so what I've actually proposed is that each of these three terms should be understood in addition to the policy content. We should also think about them in an identity-based way. So polarization is not just disagreeing. It's also really hating each other, right? There's this level of visceral, emotional, really prejudice between Democrats and Republicans. And we should think about polarization not completely as disagreement. And ideology also has an identity. So liberals and conservatives, yes, are defined by the policies they prefer, but they also identify as liberals and conservatives. Well, liberals think that other people who are called liberals are very much like them. They say we when they talk about the group, that kind of thing. So there's an identity with ideology. And then third, sorting, and this is really the key to the whole book. Instead of thinking about sorting as just Democrats and Republicans becoming more liberal and conservative, respectively, what I've actually seen is since the 1960s, Democrats and Republicans have become what I call socially sorted. So that means that the social groups that make up the two parties have been dividing, and the parties have become socially distinct from each other in a way that didn't used to happen. So we used to have what we call cross-cutting identities. So your next-door neighbor maybe is in a different party than you, but you go to church together. And so you have this cross-cutting identity that helps you connect on a social level. Increasingly, those connections are disappearing. So Republicans tend to be largely white, Christian, increasingly rural. Democrats are non-white, non-Christian, more metropolitan. And these differences are making Democrats and Republicans feel very different from each other.
That's very, very interesting. In your core research, I read one of your studies, and I was very, very impressed with the degree of statistical sophistication that you went through. You were comparing an element that relates to what you were just speaking to. So if you had two liberals and a conservative, or you had two conservatives and a liberal, it was almost indiscriminate in how that was structured. And let's just, for the sake of example, say we had two liberals and a Republican. The two liberals could fundamentally disagree on critical issues, and the conservative could potentially agree with one of the liberals, almost aligned identically to them. And yet the liberals would be attracted to maintaining a social relationship between each other, despite the disagreement, and reject the relationship with the conservative. Can you talk about that in more detail, what you found and some of the more compelling elements?
Yeah, so this study is actually based in this very old idea called social distance that was created in the 1920s, or was measured first in the 1920s, and it was generated in order for us to better understand racial prejudice. And so there are these questions that are things like, how willing would you be to live next door to an out-group member? And originally it was measuring race, but I used it to ask about liberals and conservatives. So if you're talking to a conservative, how willing would you be to live next door to a liberal? How willing would you be to be friends with a liberal, to be casual social acquaintances? And then the most intense one was, how willing would you be to marry a member of your ideological out-group? And I specifically looked at liberals who held extremely liberal positions, and also liberals who held really pretty conservative positions. And the same thing, conservatives with relatively liberal positions versus relatively conservative positions, and found that essentially, no matter what their positions were, they preferred to spend social time with people in their own ideological group. So this idea that we're separating ourselves from each other because we disagree so much, that just wasn't really supported by these models that I ran. And in fact, what I found was that it doesn't really matter. As long as you strongly identify with your group, liberal or conservative, you just don't want to spend time with members of the other group. And the content of your policy attitudes is almost irrelevant.
In effect, we've created a social gulf across a variety of lines driven by political identification.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would also add that, you know, what that means is that a lot of this idea about, you know, we just need to talk, right? We need to get together as partisans and talk things through, and then everything will be fine and we'll understand each other. That isn't really borne out by this research, because clearly the disagreement itself is not the problem here.
Now, there's a lot of discussion today, particularly among mainstream media, about the impact of President Trump. Obviously, he has a different personality than we're used to in that office. He has a different communication style and so forth. Has he driven a greater divide from your perspective or from your research?
Yes and no. I started this research in 2009, so I obviously didn't think about Trump when I was beginning this project. So it's been a problem that's been happening gradually over the last few decades. And so to that extent, no, he hasn't created it. He's much more of a symptom of it. But what he did do was really take advantage of it during the campaign. And by that, I mean that he essentially said to a number of aggrieved, particularly white rural people, your group is being threatened, you're being mocked, and you feel like losers, but I'm going to make you a winner. And he used this winning language over and over and over again, which really pointed out to them, you know, this sense of status threat. You can either lose or you can win. And if you stick with me, we're going to win. And that's how he really cultivated a lot of support. And then the second thing that I'll say that since the election is that Trump, one thing that he really does is takes advantage of the fact that our party identity, if it's strong enough, can cause us to ignore or interpret information in a biased way. And if you have a large number of people who are so strongly identified that they're willing, or not even necessarily willing, just this is a subconscious process by which we look for information that makes us feel good and we avoid information that doesn't make us feel good. You can almost say anything to people who are extremely strongly identified with their political group, and they will find a way to hear the thing that, makes their group right. And so that, I think, he has actually taken advantage of in the months since the election.
Right. And I think there is clarity among those who are willing to look for it. That same problem is exhibited on both sides. There are people who are trying to shape behavior, switch positions. I'm always stunned in these days where there's archived video where somebody will say that they were totally against a particular issue or totally in favor of a particular issue. And then when the power changes in DC in particular, they shift positions and they act as if they never held the other position at all. We see this in the leadership of both parties. And there's some interesting contrasts today. I threw out President Trump as an example. Let's take a counterexample on the other side. Representative Maxine Waters has come out. Now, this is a Black woman who has made racial bias the foundation of her long tenure in Washington, D.C. And recently she came out and made the comment that the opposition to President Trump should be directed at any member of his staff, his cabinet, and so forth. And her term was, you should harass them if you see them in public. So you should deny them service at a restaurant. Now, this is a Black woman suggesting that service be denied based on political affiliation. So we've kind of seen the extremes filter into this and people try and leverage it for their own political purpose. And we're going to take a quick break, Lily. And when we come back, I'd like to talk about that with you and what's happening relative to activism. Is it heading the right direction, the wrong direction, and the outrage in the partisan process as well? We'll be right back in a moment. Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Liliana Mason, a PhD in political psychology and the author of Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity. Lily, when we were finishing up the last segment, we were just talking about the tendency for both sides to take exploitive steps in using negative emotion to frame their argument, ignoring whatever's been said in the past. So let's talk about outrage and elation with regard to partisan sorting.
This actually comes out of just purely social psychological research on emotions, just human emotions. And essentially what we know about human emotions and action is that there are some kind of emotions that we call approach emotions and some that we call avoidance emotions. So approach emotions make you want to go fight and do something. And those tend to be things like anger and enthusiasm, right? If you're really enthusiastic about something or you're really angry about something, you're much more willing to get up and go fight for it. An avoidance emotion is something like fear or anxiety. So when people feel afraid or anxious, they tend to kind of sit back and just try to figure out what's going on. And the difference between these two feelings, particularly like anger and anxiety, the way that you turn something like anxiety into something like anger is actually giving people an answer about, like, in both cases, people feel threatened. They feel like something bad is happening. But if you give people, if you point to someone and you say, this is the source of your threat, right? This is where it's coming from. And you're in a group and you're in a strong position. So if you know the source of your threat and you feel strongly affiliated with your group, you're much more likely to respond with anger than with anxiety. And so what we're seeing is a lot of people, because they're feeling so much more strongly identified with their party, they're much more likely when they get some threatening information to respond by getting angry, which tends to cause them to go vote, to participate politically in a number of ways, to donate money, to just participate in activism in general. And so we're taking a lot of people who used to be kind of sitting back and watching and turning them into much more active participants in politics as it's occurring around them.
So the polarizing effect of the political divisions we have somewhat simplified the electoral process and made it easier for the parties to potentially control behavior, to drive people to the polls, to make them reach into their wallets and make a political donation. They've increased the political engagement. But that necessarily hasn't played well for society as a whole, has it?
Right. We used to think that any action was good, right? Any political activism was good because we have a sort of apathetic electorate. And it's normatively just a good thing to get people engaged. Increasingly now, what we're seeing is that this action, if it's done on behalf of anger, or if it's coming from a place of misinformation or prejudice, then it's not necessarily good. It's not necessarily good for democracy if we're all furious about something that we aren't fully understanding, or we just changed our mind about it because our political leaders told us to change our mind. And so that type of movement isn't a normative good. It actually kind of crosses the line from political organization into kind of like angry crowd. And the line between those is not, there's a very wide space between those two things. But what I write about in the book is actually that that's the place where we need to be worried about going, right? We don't want to turn into angry crowds. We want to try to keep political participation in a productive sense. And this emotion-based activism is slightly worrisome in that degree.
Without question. You know, I know one of your degrees is from Princeton University, and chair of Princeton's Department of Politics co-authored a study recently. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the research was focused on purple districts, if you will, the ones that have relative balance between liberal views and conservative views and more moderate views. And it turned out, according to the study, that the Republicans and Democrats representing purple districts do it in a very different way, and they tend to take more extreme positions. You would think that it would blend the ideas and bring people towards the center. In effect, what they've demonstrated is that the parties will become more ideologically extreme and push towards their base, figuring the people in the middle are going to have to make a choice between them anyway, and they want to focus on the people who will spend the most money and are most likely to go and cast a vote. So they leverage that approach avoidance continuum that you were discussing. Did you see anything like that in your research or anything that would support that?
So most of what I study is voters, not legislators. But I think one really important story that I can tell is some research that was done by Jeffrey Lehman, who's a social psychologist. And he did this fascinating study where he had people come in, and then he randomly assigned in a lab, it was an experiment, he randomly assigned them, he told them, this is a very stringent welfare policy, and this is a very generous welfare policy. And so for half of the people, he switched the party labels for which party would advocate which policy. So you have Democrats being told that the really stringent welfare policy is their party's position, and vice versa for Republicans. And he then asked people what their attitude was on the position on welfare, and they chose the one that matched their party, not the one that should have logically matched the party. So they just sort of blindly followed the party. And then he asked them, did your party have any influence on this position for you? And they say, no. They don't admit that their party had any influence on their position. And then the final part, which is kind of the most mind-blowing, is that he says, okay, I'd like you to write an op-ed for a local paper. I want you to know that your representatives read this paper, and so you might actually change policy. You might actually have some influence on policy when you write this. I want you to write reasons that you hold this position and support for this position. Explain to your legislator why it should be implemented. And both Republicans and Democrats, who newly have, you know, this is a brand new position, they were just given, essentially, randomly assigned by their party, they write reasons. They just were given this position. They did not believe in it the moment they walked in. And they write down reasons. So people have been, as partisans, as long as we're strongly identified with our party leaders, we can trick ourselves into believing nearly anything, even things that we tend to disagree with. Not everything, right? Like not everything is that changeable. But if our leaders are telling us things that we would think rationally, this should turn everybody off, right? Like this is too extreme. People won't listen to this. In fact, people can change their positions pretty dramatically as long as they are interested in making sure that they're a loyal partisan.
Well, that certainly shows how easy it is to manipulate us. Is there a quick fix as we close in on the last few minutes of the show? Is there a way to fix this situation going forward? What should we do as an electorate to make more informed decisions?
The best thing we could do, if I could wave a magic wand and fix this myself, I would encourage every single partisan in the country to really think about what's going through their minds when they're making decisions. And when they're hearing information, what are they criticizing and what are they accepting? Are there certain pieces of information that they're believing because they just feel good to believe, or because they actually thought about it and looked for more information in a broader way? And so the more we question whether our judgments are fair, the more we become open-minded to the possibility that we're not making fair judgments. And basically what the book demonstrates is that we are not making fair judgments. As anyone who is strongly identified as a partisan is not making fair judgments. And so just being aware of it and kind of questioning in the back of your head every time you make an assessment of an outgroup partisan, think about it for a second and be like, am I being fair when I'm thinking about this? Is this really accurate? And am I participating in a process of really dehumanizing my partisan opponents, which is really the dangerous place to be? We don't want to get to a place where we think of our partisan opponents as less than human, because that's when we go from political disagreement to closer to civil war, right? So we don't want to go anywhere near that. The other thing that could happen, which is also not really within our control, is that there could be new cross-cutting identities. So what we saw in the 1960s was that the Southern Democrats broke off of the Democratic Party and then gradually over a generation became Republicans. But during that period, there were a lot of cross-cutting identities that allowed partisans on both sides to have things in common and talk to each other. So something that could either a rift in a party again or some new identity that shows up that allows Democrats and Republicans to see each other as co-in-group members in some other way that could bring back some of the ability to talk across the aisle.
Excellent recommendations. Lily, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and your work?
So there's a New York Times op-ed that I wrote that is essentially about Trump using the language of winning. I think the title is Trump's Winning is Our Losing, and how that language can change the way that we think about politics. The book is on civil agreement. It's available on Amazon. I'm on Twitter at Lily Mason, PhD. And if they want to find my academic work, Google Scholar is the repository of where all of that is. I recommend this one, the 2015 article I have called I Disrespectfully Agree. And then this article that we were discussing earlier is called Ideologues Without Issues.
Well, thank you, Lily. I think your work is extremely interesting, and I hope those of you who are listening make an effort to read Dr. Mason's book and her published articles. They'll give you an important insight on how the parties may be influencing your thinking and not necessarily for your long-term benefit. So, Lily, thank you again for joining us on Deconstructed.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much.